disputed him. "Swear you'll follow my orders." He shrugged and looked away. "Yeah, I swear." "Not enough. Swear it on your name." He wiped the rain from his face and looked back at me, confused. "What?" I faced him and spoke formally. "Daydan, will you do as I say tonight, without questioning or hesitation? Daydan, do you swear it on your name?" He shifted from foot to foot for a moment, then straightened a little. "I swear it on my name." I stepped closer to him and said, "Daydan," very softly. At the same time, I fed a small, tiny burst of heat through the wax simulacra in my pocket. Not enough to do anything, but enough that he could feel it, just for a moment. I saw his eyes widen, and I gave him my best Taberlin the Great smile. The smile was full of secrets, wide and confident, and more than slightly smug. It was a smile that told an entire story all by itself. "I have your name now," I said softly. "I have mastery over you." The look on his face was almost worth a month of his grumbling. I stepped back and let the smile disappear, quick as a flicker of lightning. Easy as taking off a mask, which, of course, would leave him wondering which expression was the real one, the young boy or the half-glimpsed Taberlin. I turned away before I lost the moment. "Martin will scout ahead. Tempe and I will follow 5 minutes behind. That will give him time to spot their lookouts and come back to warn us. You two follow 10 minutes behind us." I gave Daydan a pointed look and held up both hands with my fingers splayed. 10 full minutes. It'll be slower this way, but it's safest. Any suggestions? Nobody said anything. "All right. Martin, it's your show. Come back if you run into trouble."
"Count on it," he said,
and soon passed from our sight, lost in the blurry green and brown of leaf and bark and rock and rain. The rain continued to pelt down, and the light was beginning to fail as Tempe and I followed the trail, slinking from one hiding place to another. Noise, at least, was not a concern as the thunder made a near constant grumbling overhead. Martin appeared with no warning from the underbrush and motioned us to the marginal shelter of a leaning maple.
"That camp is right up ahead," he said. "There's tracks all over the place, and I saw light from that fire."
"How many of them?" Martin shook his head.
"I didn't get that close. As soon as I saw different sets of footprints, I came back. I didn't want you following the wrong tracks and getting lost."
"How far?"
"About a minute's creep. You could see their fire from here, but their camp's on the other side of a rise."
I looked at the faces of my two companions in the dimming light. Neither of them seemed nervous. They were suited for this sort of work, trained for it. Martin had his abilities as a tracker and a bowman. Tempe had the legendary skill of the Adem. I might have felt calm, too, if I had the opportunity to prepare some plan, some trick of sympathy that could tip things in our favor, but Daydan had ruined all hopes of that by insisting we attack tonight. I had nothing, not even a bad link to a distant fire. I stopped that line of thinking before it could turn from anxiety to panic. "Let's go, then," I said, pleased at the calm timbre of my voice. The three of us crept forward as the last of the light slowly bled from the sky. In the gray, Martin and Tempe were difficult to see, which reassured me. If it was hard for me, it would be near impossible for sentries to spot us from a distance. Soon, I spied firelight reflecting off the undersides of high branches ahead. Crouching, I followed Martin and Tempe up the side of a steep bank made slippery by the rain. I thought I saw a stir of movement ahead of us. Then lightning struck. In the near dark it was enough to blind me, but not before the muddy bank was highlighted in dazzling white. A tall man stood on the ridge with a drawn bow. Tempe crouched a few feet up the bank, frozen in the act of carefully placing his feet. Above him was Martin. The old tracker had gone to one knee and drawn his bow as well. The lightning showed me all of this in a great flash, then left me blind. The thunder came an instant after, deafening me as well. I dropped to the ground and rolled, wet leaves and dirt clinging to my face. When I opened my eyes, all I could see were the blue ghosts the lightning had left dancing in front of my eyes. There was no outcry. If the sentry had made one, it had been covered by the thunder. I lay very still until my eyes adjusted. It took me a long, breathless second to find Tempe. He was up the bank some 15 feet, kneeling over a dark shape. The sentry. I approached him, scrabbling through the wet fern and muddy leaves. Lightning flickered again above us, more gently this time, and I saw the shaft of one of Martin's arrows protruding at an angle from the sentry's chest. The fletching had come loose, and it fluttered in the wind like a tiny, sodden flag.
"Dead,"
Tempe said when Martin and I were close enough to hear. I doubted it. Even a deep chest wound won't kill a man as quickly as that. But as I moved closer, I saw the angle of the arrow. It was a heart shot. I looked at Martin with amazement.
"That's a shot to sing a song about," I said quietly.
"Luck."
He dismissed it and turned his attention to the top of the ridge a few feet above us.
"Let's hope I have some left," he said as he began to crawl.
As I crawled after him, I caught a glimpse of Tempe still kneeling over the fallen man. He leaned close, as if whispering to the body. Then I saw the camp, and all vague curiosity about the Adem's peculiarity was pushed from my mind. Chapter 91. Flame, Thunder, Broken Tree. The ridge we crouched on made a wide half-circle, holding the bandits' camp in the center of a protective crescent. The result was that the camp sat at the bottom of a large, shallow bowl. From our position, I could see the open portion of the bowl was bordered by a stream that curved in and away. The trunk of a towering oak tree rose like a pillar in the center of the bowl, sheltering the camp with its huge branches. Two fires burned sullenly on either side of the great oak. Both would have been big as bonfires if not for the weather. As it was, they merely shed enough light to reveal the camp. Camp is a misleading term. Encampment would be better. There were 6 field tents, short and sloping, mostly intended for sleeping and storing equipment. The 7th tent was almost a small pavilion, rectangular and large enough for several men to stand upright. 6 men sat huddled close to the fires on makeshift benches. They were bundled up against the rain, all of them with the hard-eyed, long-suffering look of experienced soldiers. I ducked back below the ridgeline and was surprised to feel no fear at all. I turned to Martin and saw his eyes were a little wild.
"How many do you think there are?" I asked.
His eyes flickered thoughtfully.
"At least 2 to a tent. If their leader keeps to the big tent, that makes 13, and we've killed 3, so 10. 10 at the very least."
He licked his lips nervously.
"But they could be sleeping as many as 4 to a tent, and the big tent could sleep 5 more in addition to the leader. That makes 30, less 3.
"So at best we're outnumbered 2 to 1, I said. "Do you like those odds?" His eyes moved to the ridge line, then back to me.
"I'd take 2 to 1. We've got surprise. We're right up close."
He paused and coughed into his sleeve. He spat.
"But there's 20 of them down there. I can feel it in my balls."
"Can you convince Dadan?" He nodded.
"He'll believe me. He's not half the ass he seems most of the time."
"Good." I considered briefly. Things had been happening more quickly than I can tell them aloud. So despite everything that had happened, Dadan and Hespa were still 5 or 6 minutes behind us. "Go turn the 2 of them around," I told Martin. "Then come back for Tempe and me." He looked uncertain.
"You sure you don't want to come now? We don't know when their god might change."
"I'll have Tempe with me. Besides, it should only take you a couple minutes. I want to see if I can get a better count of how many there are."
Martin hurried off, and Tempe and I edged our way back up to the top of the ridge. After a moment, He edged closer until the left side of his body was pressed up against my right. I noticed something I'd missed earlier. There were wooden poles the size of tall fence posts scattered throughout the camp.
Posts?
I asked Tempe, driving my finger into the ground to illustrate what I mean. He nodded to show he understood, then shrugged. I guessed they might be tethers for horses, or drying poles for sodden clothes. I pushed it from my mind in favor of more pressing matters.
What do you think we should do?
Tempe was silent for a long moment.
Kill some. Leave. Wait. Others come. We...
He gave the characteristic pause that meant he was lacking the word he wanted to use.
Jump behind trees.
Surprise.
He nodded.
We surprise. Wait. Hunt rest. Tell mayor.
I nodded. Not the quick resolution we had hoped for, but the only sane option against this number of men. When Martin came back, the three of us would take our first sting at them. I guessed, with surprise on our side, Martin could mark as many as three or four with his bow before we were forced to flee. Odds were he wouldn't kill all of them, but any man arrow-shot would be less of a threat to us in the days to come.
Any other way?
A long pause.
No way that is of the Lithani, he said.
Having seen enough, I carefully slid down several feet until I was out of sight. I shivered as the rain continued to pelt down. It felt colder than it had a couple minutes ago, and I began to worry that I'd caught Martin's cold. That was the last thing I needed right now. I caught sight of Martin approaching, and was about to explain our plan when I saw his panicked expression.
I can't find them.
He hissed frantically.
I trailed back to where they should have been, but they weren't there. So either they already turned back, which they wouldn't do, or they were too close behind us and ended up following the wrong set of tracks in this bad light.
I felt a chill that had nothing to do with the constant rain.
Can't you track them down?
If I could, I would have. But all the prints look the same in the dark. What are we gonna do?
He clutched at my arm. I could tell by his eyes that he was on the verge of panic.
They won't be careful. They'll think we've scouted everything ahead of them. What should we do?
I reached into the pocket that held Daydan's simulacra.
I can find them.
But before I could do anything, there was an outcry from the eastern edge of the camp. It was followed a second later by a furious shout and a string of cursing.
Is that Daydan? I asked.
Martin nodded. From over the ridge came the sound of frantic movement. The three of us moved as quickly as we dared, peering over the top. Men were swarming from the low tents like hornets from a nest. There were at least a dozen of them now, and I saw four with strung bows. Long sections of planking appeared from nowhere and were leaned against the posts, making crude walls about 4 feet high. Within seconds, the vulnerable, wide-open camp became a veritable fortress. I counted at least 16 men, but now whole sections of the camp were cut off from view. The light was worse as well, as the makeshift walls blocked the fires and cast deep shadows against the night. Martin was swearing a steady stream, understandably, as his bow wasn't nearly as useful now. He knocked an arrow quick as winking, and might have fired it just as fast if I hadn't laid a hand on his arm.
Wait!
He frowned, then nodded, knowing they would have half a dozen arrows for every one of his. Tempe was suddenly useless as well. He would be riddled with arrows long before he came close to the camp. The only bright facet was that their attention wasn't directed toward us. They were focused off to the east where we had heard the sentry's cry and Daydan's cursing. The three of us might escape before we were discovered, but that would mean leaving Daydan and Hespa behind. This was the time when a skilled arcanist should be able to tip the scales, if not to give us an advantage, then at least to make escape possible. But I had no fire, no link. I was clever enough to make do without one of those, but without both, I was nearly helpless. Rain began to pour down more heavily. Thunder grumbled. It was only a matter of time before the bandits figured out there were only two of them and rushed over the ridge to make short work of our companions. If the three of us drew their attention, We would be overrun just as quickly. There was a concert of gentle hums, and a flight of arrows leapt over the eastern ridge. Martin stopped swearing and held his breath. He looked at me.
"What are we gonna do?"
he said urgently. There was a questioning shout from the camp, and when no answer was forthcoming, another flight of arrows hummed over the eastern ridge, finding the range of their target.
"What are we gonna do?"
Martin repeated.
"What if they're hurt?"
"What if they're dead?" I closed my eyes and slid down below the ridgeline, trying to gain a moment of clear thought. My foot bumped something soft and solid. The dead sentry. A dark thought occurred. I drew a deep breath and threw myself into the heart of stone, deep, deeper than I had ever been before. All fear left me, all hesitation. I took hold of the body by its wrist and began to drag it up toward the lip of the ridge. He was a heavy man, but I hardly noticed. "Martin, may I use your dead?" I asked absently. The words were in a pleasant baritone, the calmest voice I had ever heard. Without waiting for an answer, I looked over the ridgeline toward the camp. I saw one of the men behind the wall bending his bow for another shot. I drew my long, slender knife of good Ramsden steel and fixed the image of the bowman in my mind. I set my teeth and stabbed the dead sentry in the kidney. The knife went in slowly, as if I were stabbing heavy clay instead of flesh. A scream rose above the sound of the thunder. The man fell, his bow flying wildly out of his hands. Another mercenary stooped to look at his companion. I refocused and stabbed the sentry in his other kidney, using both hands this time. There was a second scream, shriller than the first. More a keen than a scream, I thought, in an odd separate corner of my mind. "Don't shoot yet," I cautioned Martin calmly, not looking away from the camp. "They still don't know where we are." I drew the knife out, refocused, and drove it coolly into the sentry's eye. A man stood upright behind the wooden wall, blood pouring down his face from underneath his clutching hands. Two of his comrades rose, trying to get him back below the wooden parapet. My knife rose and fell, and one of them toppled to the ground even as his hands rose to his own bleeding face.
"Holy God!"
Martin choked.
"Dear holy God!"
I set the knife against the sentry's throat and surveyed the camp. Their military efficiency was falling apart as they began to panic. One of the wounded men continued to scream, high and piercing over the grumbling thunder. I saw one of the bowmen searching the ridgeline with hard eyes. I drew the knife across the sentry's throat, but nothing seemed to happen. Then, the bowman looked puzzled and raised his hand to touch his own throat. It came away lightly smeared with blood. His eyes grew wide and he began to shout. Dropping his bow, he ran to the other side of the low wall, then back, trying to escape but not knowing where to run. Then, he regained his composure and began desperately searching the ridgeline all around the camp. He showed no signs of falling. I frowned, set the knife against the dead sentry's neck again, and leaned against it hard. My arms trembled, but the knife began to move again, slowly, as if I were trying to cut a block of ice. The bowman's hands flew to his neck, and blood poured over them. He staggered, stumbled, and fell into one of the fires. He thrashed wildly, scattering burning coals everywhere, adding to the confusion. I was deciding where to strike next when lightning lit the sky, showing me a clear, stark picture of the body. The rain had mingled with the blood, and it was everywhere. My hands were dark with it. Unwilling to maim his hands, I rolled him over onto his stomach and struggled to remove his boots. Then I refocused myself and sawed through the thick tendons above the ankles and behind the knees. It crippled two more men, but the knife was moving more and more slowly, and my arms ached with the strain of it. The corpse was an excellent link, but the only energy I had was the strength of my body. Under these conditions, it felt more like I was cutting wood than flesh. It had been scarcely more than a minute or two since the camp had been alerted. I spat water and took a moment's rest for my trembling arms and exhausted mind. I eyed the camp below, watching the confusion and panic build. A man emerged from the large tent at the base of the tree. He was dressed differently than the others, wearing a hauberk of bright chainmail that came nearly to his knees with a coif covering his head. He stepped into the chaos with a fearless grace, taking everything in at a glance. He snapped orders I couldn't hear over the sound of rain and thunder. His men calmed, settled back into their positions, and took up their bows and swords. As I watched him stride across the encampment, I was reminded of something. He stood in plain view, not bothering to crouch behind one of the protective walls. He gestured to his men, and something in that motion was terribly familiar.
"Quoth!"
Martin hissed. I looked up to see the tracker with his bow drawn tight to his ear.
"I've got the shot on that boss!"
"Take it."
His bow hummed, and the man sprouted an arrow from his upper thigh, piercing the chainmail, the leg itself, and the armor behind it. From the corner of my eye, I saw Martin draw another arrow and put it to the string in a fluid motion, but before he could shoot it, I saw their leader bend. Not a deep bending at the waist as if he were doubling over in pain. He bent at the neck to look down at the arrow that had pierced his leg. After a second's scrutiny, he grasped the arrow in a fist and snapped off the fletching. Then, he reached behind himself and pulled the arrow from his leg. I froze as he looked straight toward us and pointed to our position with the hand that held the broken arrow. He spoke a brief word of command to his men, tossed the arrow into the fire, and stalked gracefully to the other side of the camp.
"Great Talu, overroll me with your wings,"
Martin said, his hand falling away from his bowstring.
"Protect me from demons and creatures that walk in the night."
Only the fact that I was deep in the heart of stone kept me from a similar reaction. I turned back to the camp in time to see a small forest of bows being bent in our direction. I ducked my head and aimed a kick at the stupefied tracker, knocking him over as the arrows hummed past. He tumbled over, his quiver of arrows scattering down the muddy bank.
"Tempe,"
I called.
"Here,"
he replied from off to my left.
"Ayish, no arrow."
More arrows sang overhead, a few of them sticking into trees. Soon, they would get the range and start arcing the arrows down overhead so they fell on us from above. A thought came to me as calmly as a bubble rising to the surface of a pond.
"Tempe, bring me this man's bow."
"Iya."
I heard Martin muttering something, his voice low, urgent, and indistinct. At first, I thought he'd been shot. Then I realized he was praying.
"Talu, shelter me from iron and anger," he murmured softly. "Talu, keep me safe from demons in the night."
Tempe pushed the bow into my hand. I took a deep breath and broke my mind into two pieces, then three, then four. In each piece of my mind, I held the bowstring. I forced myself to relax and broke my mind again, five. I tried again and failed. Tired, wet, and cold, I had reached my limit. I heard bowstrings thrum again and arrows hit the ground around us like a heavy rain. I felt a tug on the outside of my arm near my shoulder as one of the arrows grazed me before burying itself in the dirt. There was a stinging, then a burning pain. I pushed the pain away and set my teeth. Five would have to be enough. I drew my knife lightly across the back of my own arm, just enough to draw a little blood. Then, mouthed the proper bindings and drew the blade across the bowstring, hard. The string held for a terrifying moment, then parted. The bow jerked in my hand, jolting my wounded arm before it flew out of my grasp. Cries of pain and dismay came over the ridge, letting me know I'd been at least partly successful. Hopefully, all five strings had been severed, leaving us with only one or two bowmen to deal with. But as soon as the bow flung itself out of my grasp, I felt the cold leech into me. Not just my arms, but all the way through me, stomach, chest, and throat. I had known I couldn't trust the strength of my arm alone to make it through five bowstrings at once. So I had used the only fire that is always with an arcanist, the heat of my blood. Binder's chills would have me soon. If I didn't find a way to get warm, I would lapse into shock, then hypothermia, then death.
I fell out of the heart of stone and let the pieces of my mind slide back together, reeling a bit in confusion. Chill, wet, and dizzy, I clawed my way back to the top of the ridgeline. The rain felt cold as sleet on my skin. I saw only one bowman. Unfortunately, he had kept his wits about him, and as soon as my face appeared over the top of the ridge, he drew and let fly in a smooth motion. A gust of wind saved me. His arrow struck harsh yellow sparks from a stone outcrop not 2 feet from my head. Rain pelted my face, and lightning spidered across the sky. I pushed myself back down out of sight and stabbed the sentry's body over and over in a delirious rage. Finally, I struck a buckle, and the blade snapped. Panting, I dropped the broken knife. I came back to my senses with the sound of Martin's forlorn praying in my ears. My limbs felt cold as lead, heavy and awkward. Worse than that, I could feel the numb sluggishness of hypothermia creeping through me. I realized I wasn't shivering and knew it was a bad sign. I was soaking wet with no fire nearby to call my own. Lightning etched the sky again. I had an idea. I laughed a terrible laugh. I looked over the top of the ridge and was pleased to see no bowmen. But the leader was barking new orders, and I didn't doubt new bows would be found or strings replaced. Worse, they might simply abandon their shelter and overrun us with sheer numbers. There were easily a dozen men still standing. Martin still lay praying on the bank.
Talu, who the fire could not kill, watch over me in fire.
I kicked at him. Get up here, damn you, or we're all dead. He paused in his praying and looked up. I shouted something incomprehensible and leaned over to drag him upward by the scruff of his shirt. I shook him hard and thrust his bow at him with my other hand, not knowing how it had come to be there. Lightning flashed again and showed me what he saw. My hands and arms were covered with the sentry's blood. The pelting rain made it streak and run, but hadn't washed it away. It looked black in the brief, glaring light. Martin took his bow numbly.
Shoot the tree!
I shouted over the thunder. He looked at me as if I had gone mad.
Shoot it!
Something in my expression must have convinced him, but his arrows were scattered, and he took up his litany again as he searched the muddy bank for one.
Talu, who held Encanis to the wheel, watch over me in darkness.
After a long moment of searching, he found an arrow and fumbled to fit it to his string with trembling hands, praying all the while. I turned my attention back to the camp. Their leader had brought them back under control. I could see his mouth shouting orders, but all I could hear was the sound of Martin's trembling voice.
Talu, whose eyes are true, watch over me.
Suddenly, the leader paused and cocked his head. He held himself perfectly still as if listening to something. Martin continued praying.
Talu, son of yourself, watch over me.
Their leader looked quickly to the left and right, as if he had heard something that disturbed him. He cocked his head again.
He can hear you!
I shouted madly at Martin.
Shoot! He's getting them ready to do something!
Martin took aim at the tree in the center of the camp. Wind buffeted him as he continued to pray.
Talu, who was Menda, who you were, watch over me in Menda's name, in Periel's name, in Odil's name, in Andan's name, watch over me.
Their leader turned his head, as if to search the sky for something. Something about the motion seemed terribly familiar, but my thoughts were growing muddy as binder's chills tightened their grip. The bandit leader turned and bounded for the tent, disappearing inside.
Shoot the tree!
I screamed. He let the arrow fly, and I saw it wedge firmly into the trunk of the massive oak that loomed in the center of the bandit's camp. I scrabbled in the mud for one of Martin's scattered arrows and began to laugh at what I was going to attempt. It might do nothing. It might kill me, the slippage alone. But it didn't matter. I was dead already unless I found a way to get warm and dry. I would go into shock soon. Perhaps I was already there. My hand closed on an arrow. I broke my mind 6 ways and shouted my bindings as I drove it deep into the sodden ground.
As above, so below!
I shouted, making a joke only someone from the university could hope to understand. A second passed. The wind faded. There was a whiteness, a brightness, a noise. I was falling. Then nothing. Chapter 92, Taberlin the Great. I woke. I was warm and dry. It was dark. I heard a familiar voice questioning. Martin's voice.
It was all him. He did it.
Questioning.
I won't never say, Den. I swear to God I won't. I don't want to think of it. Get him to tell you if you want.
Questioning.
You'd know if you'd seen. Then you wouldn't want to know no more. Don't cross him. I've seen him angry. That's all I'll say. Don't cross him.
Questioning.
Leave off, Den.
He was killing them one by one. Then he went a little crazy. He...
No. All I'll say is this.
I think he called the lightning down.
Like God himself.
Like Taberlin the Great, I thought. And smiled. And slept. Chapter 93, Mercenaries All. After 14 hours of sleep, I was fit as a fiddle. My companions seemed surprised by this, as they'd found me unconscious, cold to the touch, and covered in blood. They had stripped me, rubbed my limbs a bit, then rolled me in blankets and put me inside the bandit's single surviving tent. The other 5 had been either burned, buried, or lost when a great white pillar of lightning blasted the tall oak that stood at the center of the bandit's camp. The next day was overcast, but blessedly free of rain. First, we tended to our hurts. Hespa had taken an arrow in the leg when the sentry had surprised them. Daydan had a deep gash along one of his shoulders, which was fairly lucky considering he'd rushed the sentry barehanded. When I asked him about it, he said he simply hadn't had time to draw his sword. Martin had an angry red lump on his forehead above one eyebrow, either from when I had kicked him over or dragged him around. It was tender to the touch, but he claimed he had gotten worse a dozen times in tavern brawls. After I recovered from the chills, I was fine. I could tell my companions were surprised by my sudden return from the doors of death and decided to leave them to their amazement. A little mystery wouldn't hurt my reputation. I bandaged the ragged cut where the arrow had grazed my shoulder and tended to a few bruises and scrapes I didn't remember receiving. I also had the long, shallow cut I had made on the top of my arm, but it was barely worth stitches. Tempe was unhurt, unruffled, unreadable. Our second order of business was to tend to the dead. While I had been unconscious, the rest of the group had pulled most of the burned, lifeless bodies to one side of the clearing. They tallied thus. 1 sentry killed by Daydan. 2 who had surprised Tempe in the forest. 3 who had survived the lightning and tried to escape. Martin brought 1 down. Tempe claimed the other 2. 17 burned, broken, or otherwise ravaged by the lightning. Of those, 8 had been dead or wounded unto death beforehand. We found tracks of 1 sentry who had watched the whole incident from the northeast piece of the ridge. His tracks were a day old before we found them, and none of us felt the slightest desire to hunt him down. Daydan pointed out he might be worth more alive if he spread word of this spectacular defeat to others who were thinking of banditry as a way of life. For once, we agreed on something. The leader's body was not among those gathered. The large tent he had ducked into had been crushed beneath large sections of the huge oak's blasted trunk. Having more than enough to occupy us for the time being, we left his remains alone for now. Rather than try to dig 23 graves, or even a mass grave large enough for 23 bodies, we built a pyre and kindled it while the surrounding forest was still wet with rain. I used my skills to ensure it burned hot and hard. But there was 1 other. The sentry Martin had shot and I had put to use. While my companions were busy collecting wood for the pyre, I went over to the south side of the ridge and found where Tempe had hidden him away, covered with a fir branch. I looked at the body for a long time before I carried it away to the south. I found a quiet place under a willow and built a cairn of stones. Then, I crept into the underbrush and was quietly, violently sick. The lightning? Well, the lightning is difficult to explain. A storm overhead. A galvanic binding with two similar arrows. An attempt to ground the tree more strongly than any lightning rod. Honestly, I don't know if I can take credit for the lightning striking when and where it did, but as far as stories go, I called the lightning, and it came. From the stories the others told, when the lightning struck, it wasn't a single startling bolt, but several in quick succession. Daydan described it as a pillar of white fire, and said it shook the ground hard enough to knock him off his feet. Regardless of why, the towering oak was reduced to a charred stump about the height of a graystone. Huge pieces of it lay scattered about. Smaller trees and shrubs had caught fire and been doused by the rain. Most of the long planks the bandits had used for their fortifications had exploded into pieces no bigger than the tip of your finger or burned to charcoal. Streaking out from the base of the tree were great tracks of churned-up earth, making the clearing look as if it had been plowed by a madman or raked by the claws of some huge beast. Despite this, we stayed at the bandits' camp for 3 days following our victory. The stream provided easy water, and what remained of the bandits' provisions were superior to our own. What's more, after we salvaged some lumber and canvas, each of us had the luxury of a tent or lean-to. With our job completed, the tensions plaguing our group faded. The rain stopped, and we didn't need to be bashful about our fires anymore. And as a result, Martin's cough was improving. Daydan and Hespa were civil to each other, and Daydan stopped about 3/4 of his incessant jackassery toward me. But despite the relief at our job being done, things weren't entirely comfortable. There were no stories at night, and Martin distanced himself from me whenever he could. I could hardly blame him, considering what he had seen. With that in mind, I took the first chance I had to privately destroy the wax mommets I had made. I had no use for them now, and I feared what might happen if one of my companions discovered them in my travel sack. Tempe made no comment on what I'd done with the bandit's body, and from what I could tell, he didn't seem to hold it against me. Looking back, I realize how little I truly understood the Adem. But at the time, all I noticed was that Tempe spent less time helping me practice the K-10 and more time practicing our language and discussing the ever-confusing concept of the Lethani. We fetched our equipment from our previous camp on the second day. I was relieved to have my loot back and doubly glad to find Denna's marvelous case had stayed dry and tight despite the endless rain. And, since we were no longer slinking about, I played. For a solid day, I did little else. It had been nearly a month since I had made any music, and I'd missed it more than you can imagine. At first, I thought Tempe didn't care for my music. Aside from the fact that I'd somehow insulted him by singing early on, he always left camp when I brought out my lute. Then, I began to catch glimpses of him watching me, though always from a distance, and usually at least partly hidden from sight. Once I knew to look for him, I discovered he was always listening while I played, wide-eyed as an owl, motionless as a stone. On the third day, Hespa decided her leg could stand a little walking, so we had to decide what was going to come with us and what would get left behind. It wasn't going to be as difficult as it might have been. Most of the bandits' equipment had been destroyed by the lightning, the falling tree, or exposure to the storm. But there were still valuables to be salvaged from the ruined camp. We had been prevented from making a good search of the leader's tent as it had been crushed beneath one of the huge branches of the fallen oak. Over 2 feet thick, the fallen limb was larger than most trees in its own right. However, on the third day we finally managed to hatchet enough of it away so we could roll it off the wreckage of the tent. I was anxious to get a closer look at the leader's body, as something about him had been nagging my memory ever since I saw him step from the tent. And, in a more worldly vein, I knew his chainmail was worth at least a dozen talents. But we didn't find any sign of the leader at all. It gave us a bit of a puzzle. Martin had only found one set of tracks leading away from the camp, those of the escaped sentry. None of us could guess where the leader had gone. To me, it was a puzzle and an annoyance, as I had been wanting to get a clearer look at his face. Daydan and Hespa believed he'd simply escaped in the chaos following the lightning, maybe using the stream to avoid leaving tracks. Martin, however, grew distinctly uneasy when we didn't find his body. He murmured something about demons and refused to go near the wreckage. I thought he was being a superstitious fool, but I won't deny that I found the missing body more than slightly unnerving as well. Inside the ruined tent, we found a table, a cot, a desk, and a pair of chairs, all shattered and useless. In the ruined desk, there were some papers I would have given a good deal to read, but they had spent too long in the wet and the ink had run. There was also a heavy hardwood box, slightly smaller than a loaf of bread. Alvaron's family crest was enameled on the cover, and it was locked tight. Both Hespa and Martin admitted they had a little skill at opening locks, and, since I was curious about what was inside, I let them have a go so long as they didn't damage the lock. Each of them took a long turn at it, but neither met with any success. After about 20 minutes of careful fiddling, Martin threw up his hands.
"I can't find the trick for it," he said as he stretched, pressing his hands against the small of his back.
"I might as well have a try myself," I said. I'd hoped one of them would trick it open. Picking locks is not the sort of skill an arcanist should pride himself on. It didn't fit with the reputation I was hoping to build for myself.
"Will you now?" Hespa said, raising an eyebrow at me. "You really are a young Tabalin."
I thought back to the story Martin had told days before.
"Of course!"
I laughed, then shouted, "Edrol!" in my best Tabalin the Great voice, and struck the top of the box with my hand. The lid sprung open. I was surprised as everyone else, but I hid it better. What had obviously happened is that one of them had actually tripped the lock, but the lid had been stuck. Probably the wood had swollen as it lay for days in the damp. When I'd struck it, it had simply come loose. But they didn't know that. From the looks on their faces, you would think I had just transmuted gold in front of them. Even Tempe raised an eyebrow.
"Nice trick, Tabalin," Hespa said,
as if she weren't sure if I were playing a joke on them. I decided to hold my tongue and slid my set of makeshift lockpicks back into the pocket of my cloak. If I was going to be an arcanist, I might as well be a famous arcanist. Doing my best to radiate an air of solemn power, I lifted the lid and looked inside. The first thing I saw was a thick folded piece of paper. I pulled it out.
"What's that?" Daydan asked.
I held it out for all of them to see. It was a careful map of the surrounding area, featuring not only an accurate depiction of the curving highway, but the locations of nearby farms and streams. Crossan, Fenhill, and the Pennysworth Inn were marked and labeled on the western road.
"What's that?" Daydan asked,
gesturing with a thick finger to an unlabeled X deep in the forest on the south side of the road.
"I think it's this camp," Martin said, pointing. "Right next to that stream."
I nodded. "If this is right, we're closer to Crossan than I thought. We could just head southeast from here and save ourselves more than a day's walking." I looked at Martin. "Does that seem right to you?"
"Here. Let me see."
I handed him the map and he looked it over.
"It looks like it," he agreed. "I didn't think we had come that far south. We'd save at least 24 miles going that way."
"That's no small blessing," Hespa said, rubbing at her bandaged leg. "That is, unless one of you gentlemen would like to carry me."
I turned my attention back to the lockbox. It was full of tightly wrapped cloth packages. Lifting one out, I saw the glint of gold. There was a murmur from everyone present. I checked the rest of the small heavy bundles and was greeted with more coins, all gold. At a rough count, there were over 200 royals. While I'd never actually held one, I knew a single royal was worth 80 bits, almost as much as the mayor had given me to finance this entire trip. No wonder the mayor had been eager to stop the waylaying of his tax collectors. I juggled numbers in my head, converting the contents of the box to a more familiar currency, and came up with more than 500 silver talents. Enough money to buy a good-sized roadside inn, or an entire farmstead with all the livestock and equipage included. With that much money, you could buy yourself a minor title, a court appointment, or an officer's position in the military. I saw everyone else making their own calculations.
"How about we share a little bit of that around?"
Daydan said without much hope. I hesitated, then reached into the box. "Does a royal each seem fair to everyone?" Everyone was silent as I unwrapped one of the bundles. Daydan looked at me incredulously.
"Are you serious?"
I handed him a heavy coin. "The way I see it, less scrupulous people might forget to tell Alvaron about this. Or they'd never go back to Alvaron at all. I think a royal each is a good reward for us being such honest folk." I tossed Martin and Hespa a bright gold coin each. "Besides," I added, tossing a royal to Tempe, "I was hired to find a group of bandits, not destroy a minor military encampment." I held up my royal. "This is our bonus for services beyond the call of duty." I slid it into my pocket and patted it. "Alvaron need never know about it." Daydan laughed and clapped me on the back.
"You're not so much different from the rest of us after all," he said.
I returned his smile and pressed the lid of the box closed, hearing the lock click tightly into place. I didn't mention the other two reasons for what I did. First, I was effectively buying their loyalty. They couldn't help but realize how easy it would be to simply grab the box and disappear. The thought had crossed my mind, too. 500 talents would pay my way through the university for the next 10 years with plenty to spare. Now, however, they were considerably richer, and they got to feel honest about it. A heavy piece of gold would keep their minds off the money I was carrying, though I still planned on sleeping with the locked box under my pillow at night. Second, I could use the money. Both the royal I had tucked openly into my pocket and the other three I'd palmed when handing out coins to the others. As I said, Alvaron would never know the difference, and 4 royals would cover a full term's tuition at the university. After I secured the mayor's lockbox into the bottom of my travel sack, each of us decided what we would scavenge from the bandits' equipment. The tents we left for the same reason we hadn't brought our own in the first place. They were too bulky to carry. We took as much of their food as we could stow, knowing the more we carried, the less we would have to buy. I decided to take one of the bandits' swords. I wouldn't have wasted the money to buy one, since I didn't know how to use it, but if they were free for the taking. As I was looking over the assorted weapons, Tempe came over and gave a few words of advice. After we had narrowed my options to 2 swords, Tempe finally spoke his mind.
"You cannot use a sword."
Questioning, embarrassment. I got the impression that to him, the thought of someone not being able to use a sword was more than slightly shameful, like not knowing how to eat using a knife and fork.
"No," I said slowly. "But I was hoping you could show me."
Tempe stood very still and quiet. I might have taken it for a refusal if I had not come to know him so well. This type of stillness meant he was thinking. Pauses are a key part of Ademic conversation, so I waited patiently. The 2 of us stood quietly for a minute. Then 2. Then 5. Then 10. I fought to stay still and quiet. Perhaps this was a polite refusal. I thought myself terribly savvy, you see. I had known Tempe for nearly a month, learned 1,000 words and 50 pieces of the Adem hand speech. I knew the Adem were not bashful about nudity or touching, and I was beginning to grasp the mystery that was the Lethani. Oh yes, I thought I was terribly clever. Had I truly known anything about the Adem, I never would have dared to ask Tempe such a question.
Will you teach me that?
He pointed across the camp to where my loot case lay, leaning against a tree. I was caught off guard by the question. I had never tried to teach anyone how to play the lute before. Perhaps Tempe knew this and was implying something similar about himself. I knew he was prone to subtly layered speaking. A fair offer. I nodded. I will try. Tempe nodded and pointed to one of the swords we had been considering.
Wear it. But no fighting.
With that, he turned and left. At the time, I took this for his natural brevity. The scavenging continued throughout the day. Martin took a good number of arrows and all the bowstrings he could find. Then, after checking to see no one wanted any of them, he decided to take the 4 longbows that had survived the lightning. They made an awkward bundle, but he claimed they'd be worth a heavy penny when he sold them in Crossan. Daydan grabbed a pair of boots and an armored vest nicer than the one he was wearing. He also laid claim to a deck of cards and a set of ivory dice. Hespa took a slender set of shepherd's pipes and tucked almost a dozen knives into the bottom of her pack with the hope of selling them later. Even Tempe found some things he fancied. A whetstone, a brass salt box, and a pair of linen pants he took down to the stream and dyed a familiar blood red. I took less than the rest of them. A small knife to replace the one I'd broken, and a small shaving razor with a horn handle. I didn't need to shave that often, but I'd gotten into the habit while in the mayor's court. I might have followed Hespa's example and taken a few knives as well, but my travel sack was already unpleasantly heavy with the weight of the mayor's lockbox. This may seem a little ghoulish, but it is simply the way of the world. Looters become looted, while time and tide make us mercenaries all. Chapter 94, Over Rock and Root. We decided to trust the map we'd found and cut straight west through the forest, heading toward Crossan. Even if we missed the town, we couldn't help but hit the road and save ourselves long miles of walking. Hespa's wounded leg made the going slow, and we only put 6 or 7 miles behind us that first day. It was during one of our many breaks that Tempe began my true instruction in the K-10. Fool that I was, I'd assumed he had already been teaching me. The truth was, he had merely been correcting my more horrifying mistakes because they irritated him. Much the same way I'd be tempted to tune someone's lute if they were playing off-key in the same room. This instruction was a different thing entirely. We started at the beginning of the K-10, and he corrected my mistakes. All my mistakes. He found 18 in the first motion alone, and there are more than 100 motions in the K-10. I quickly began to have doubts about this apprenticeship. I also began to teach Tempe the lute. I played notes as we walked and taught him their names, then showed him some chords. It seemed as good a place as any to begin. We hoped to make it to Crossan by noon of the next day, but near mid-morning we encountered a stretch of dreary, reeking swamp that hadn't been marked on the map. Thus began a truly miserable day. We had to test our footing with every step, and our progress slowed to a crawl. At one point, Daydan startled and fell, thrashing about and spattering the rest of us with brackish water. He said he'd seen a mosquito bigger than his thumb with a sucker like a woman's hairpin. I suggested it might have been a sipquick. He suggested several unpleasant, unsanitary things I could do to myself at my earliest convenience. As the afternoon wore on, we gave up on making it back to the road and focused on more immediate things, such as finding a piece of dry ground where we could sit without sinking. But all we found was more marsh, sinkholes, and clouds of keening mosquitoes and biting flies. The sun began to set before we finally made our way out of the swamp, and the weather quickly turned from hot and muggy to chill and damp. We trudged until the ground finally began to slope upward, and though we were all weary and wet, we unanimously decided to press on and put a little distance between ourselves and the insects and smell of rotting plants. The moon was full, giving us more than enough light to pick our way through the trees. Despite the miserable day, our spirits began to rise.
Hespa had grown tired enough to lean on Daydan, and as the mud-covered mercenary put an arm around her, she told him he hadn't smelled this good in months. He replied that he would have to bow to the judgment of a woman of such obvious grace. I tensed, waiting for their banter to turn sour and sarcastic, but as I plodded along behind them, I noticed how gently he had his arm around her. Hespa leaned on him almost tenderly, hardly favoring her wounded leg at all. I glanced at Martin, and the old tracker smiled, his teeth white in the moonlight. Before long, we found a clear stream and washed the worst of the smell and mud away. We rinsed out our clothes and donned dry ones. I unpacked my tatty, threadbare cloak and fastened it across my chest, vainly hoping it might keep away the evening's chill. As we were finishing up, we heard the faint sound of singing upstream. Each of us pricked up our ears, but the chattering sound of the stream made it difficult to hear with any clarity. But singing meant people, and people meant we were almost a crossin', or perhaps even the Pennyworth if the swamp had turned us too far south. Even a farmhouse would be better than another night in the rough. So, despite the fact that we were tired and aching, the hope of soft beds, warm meals, and cool drinks gave us energy to gather up our packs and press on. We followed the stream, Daydan and Hespa still walking as a pair. The sound of singing came and went. The recent rains meant the stream was running high, and the noise of it tumbling over rock and root was sometimes enough to drown out even the sound of our own footsteps. Eventually, the stream grew broad and still as the heavy brush thinned and opened into a wide clearing. There was no singing any longer, nor did we see a road, inn, or any flicker of firelight. Just a wide clearing well lit by moonlight. The stream broadened out, forming a bright pool, and sitting on a smooth rock by the side of the pool.
"Lord Talu, protect me from the demons of the night," Martin said woodenly, but he sounded more reverent than afraid, and he did not look away.
"That's," Daydan said weakly, "that's..."
"I do not believe in fairies," I tried to say,
but it came out as barely a whisper. It was Felurian. Chapter 95. Chased. The five of us stood frozen for a moment. The slow rippling of the pool reflected onto the fair form of Felurian, naked in the moonlight. She sang,
"Selani and Luhiel, de Mari Felanua, Creata tu Sier, tu Alarandi, Direla, Amauan, Losi Andalan, tu Nia Vorulan, Felurian Te."
The sound of her voice was strange. It was soft and gentle, far too quiet for us to hear across the entire length of the clearing, far too faint for us to hear over the sound of moving water and stirring leaves. Despite this, I could hear it. Her words were clear and sweet as the rising and falling notes of a distant flute. It reminded me of something I could not press my finger to. The tune was the same that Daydan had sung in his story. I did not understand a word of it save her name in the final line. Nevertheless, I felt the draw of it, inexplicable and insistent. As if an unseen hand had reached into my chest and tried to pull me into the clearing by my heart. I resisted. I looked away and set one hand against a nearby tree to steady myself. Behind me, I heard Martin murmuring,
"No, no, no,"
in a low voice, as if he were trying to convince himself.
"No, no, 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 not for all the money in the world."
I looked over my shoulder. The tracker's eyes were fixed feverishly on the clearing in front of him, but he seemed more afraid than aroused. Tempe stood, surprise plain on his normally impassive face. Daydan stood rigidly to one side, his face drawn while Hespa's eyes darted back and forth between him and the clearing. Then Felurian began to sing again. It felt like the promise of a warm hearth on a cold night. It was like a young girl's smile. I found myself thinking of Losi at the Pennyworth, her red curls like a tumble of fire.
I remembered the swell of her breasts and the way her hand had felt running through my hair.